The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Okay, we'll go ahead and start. My name is Craig Dirksen. I am the upper school head at Regents in Austin. I've been there for 8 years. And I'm excited about today's talk. And actually, there have been a number of things that have happened there that I've heard in the context of the conference that have kind of continued to resonate with the topic. I think actually Dr. Mueller's talk this morning in particular, there was one thing that struck me that this question, we're looking at projects and what it is we're trying to accomplish, a particular theological truth came home, and it's simply this. The grandiose scale of what we are doing, what we are trying to draw our students into so that they understand what it means to be fully human in the image of God is... it is at the highest point of ideal, of vision of the whole order of things. And we are teachers of children, and they don't function up there. And the thing that it struck me as I was thinking about and just listening to Dr. Mueller and thinking about what it is that we do, and I thought, this is an expression of incarnation. God had the same grandiose reality that he created, and yet pillars of cloud and pillars of thunder don't actually communicate to our hearts God's love the way that anything could, except for Jesus Christ, God becoming incarnate. What we are doing is incarnational when we teach. There are these truths, there are the transcendentals that are unchanging, that are real, that are beautiful, the true good and the beautiful. We are incarnating those for our students. And it is a difficult task. It is not, we could talk about that truth is truth and good is good and beauty is beautiful and it's not pretty and it's not truthiness and all those things, but to actually lead our students to know those things is more than just talking about them. We have to figure out how to actually lead them into that knowledge and that understanding. And that's when we as teachers start to go, how do I do this? I can't just stand up here all the time. I need to get them to do things. And so this category of pedagogy called projects comes in. And it's kind of all the rave because it's like project-based learning, it's hands-on, it's you know, all these different things. And yet most of us have had experiences where the ideal of project-based learning does not match the reality. So I have two things to disclose so that you know who is the person as it relates to projects who's talking to you about leading projects that make sense and not frustration. Number one, pretty much all through my middle school and high school, I dreaded any time that a teacher said, we're going to now do a project. Because it meant that I was probably going to have to work with other people that would be less efficient and interested in it than I would. I would have to go ahead and do it myself and then find out some way to parcel their handwriting so it looked like we all did it together. And I would find it completely meaningless in terms of what I was trying to learn. I was like, oh, we're done learning now. We're going to do a project. So I personally have this, that reflects the kinds of projects I experienced. So there's the first one that I have kind of for my own journey, a certain antipathy to projects. The second one is 7 years ago at Regents. At the time I was, the upper school incorporated our school of logic, our middle school, as well as our high school. I had parents, I'm sure none of you all are at schools that had this problem, but I had parents that were frustrated with the level of work that was required. There was too much time on too many classes, and Mr. Dirksen, you've come in and you need to fix this. And so I did a very thorough, we've probably all been at schools that have done this, did a very thorough set of homework surveys. Had all the courses listed out, days of the week, 3-week periods of time, I got a group of dads to commit to make sure that their families would do this. And I collected it all. And the conclusion I came with is, oh my goodness, they're spending way too much time doing homework. But that was one. And then as I dug in, it became much harder to actually figure out what the fix was. Because I would have, I'll make up a number, let's say there were 10 kids that were all in life science. 3 of those kids, yeah, exact same class, exact same schedule, 3 of those kids in that 3-week period averaged about 15 minutes of homework a night. 3 of those kids did not do any homework in life science for that period. And then there would be 4 others that spent an average of 12 hours a week. And so if I tried to figure out, my goodness, how is this, this doesn't help. So then I started to dig deeper. Talking to different parents about, okay, so tell me, so I noticed that your daughter spent 12 hours this weekend on life science. What was she doing? And then we'd have that same question with Bible, and the same question with English, same question with Latin. And guess what the answer was when they had a lot of time on a particular class? They were doing a project. And this is where it got tricky, because the projects they were doing, a lot of them were beloved in the region's thick practices. But they took lots of time. So, okay, well, so it's the second time on a science project. I kind of zeroed in. I'm like, okay, these 3 girls were working together on a science project. Figure out whose home they were at. Figure out what they were doing. And then realizing that they really did spend 10 hours over the course of the weekend together on life science. One of them really got into the color things. It was this whole kind of creating the cell out of these different things that they bought at Target and everything else so they could understand the structure of a cell. And some of them had this most elaborate reconstructions of cells that you can imagine. Now, there were some boys that I was like, okay, you didn't spend any time in life science the last 3 weeks. I'm like, did you turn in the project? And they did. And so I went to Chief, like, let me see the project. And then I saw the project. And, you know, they'd found an old ping pong ball and they'd kind of stuck a hole in it and they'd done little drawings with a Sharpie that they picked up. And it actually got a good grade because it did everything it needed to. But the girls, which also got a good grade because it was beautiful, had taken them all day to do. Was there a value in them actually constructing and making sense of a cell? Absolutely. Was the project set up in such a way that it made sure that they knew how to do it and the time they spent on it was time that was relevant to life science? It wasn't. There were no fences. There was no boundaries to it. And so 7 years ago, I used life science, but there was a Bible art project. There was a Roman road out of breakfast cereal, anything else you wanted to do. All sorts of different things. And I single-handedly said, there are no more projects in our school of logic. And I killed beautiful sacred cows, and I killed all sorts of things. And my charge to the teacher was, if you want to do this, you have to come to me and tell me why it's important, what students will learn from it, how you will evaluate it, and how much time in class you're going to spend on it. And it started a process that was really healthy, and it trickled into the high school because there it was not just in the middle school, but that was kind of in the place that had been the crucible. And so it started out, and I probably still have the reputation at Regents of just being a guy that doesn't like projects, which isn't true. But it became for me the idea of a project is wonderful, but part of what we have to do is recognize who are these kids, where are they developmentally, and what are we trying to do in the first place? And so, and let me just go to a slide here that looks somewhat similar to part of your page, but there's a little bit completed there. There is a misleading continuum in a lot of our practices of teaching. And the continuum is between covering material that we have to cover in our classes because our class is about that material, and then getting to a point of exhaustion or boredom, ours or the students, and then saying, okay, we're going to do an activity. At schools less rigorous than ours, they tend towards just doing activities and saying, we're not going to cover any material. We tend to not have that. When we err on the side of trying to do too much and covering. And sometimes, and this was in your reading, sometimes what happens is we cover, their grades don't go very well, and we've got to figure out how, some way, to make sure Junior passes the class. And so we have them build a Roman road for Latin out of rec materials. We addressed the grade, but they didn't. They still aren't learning Latin. And then we just carry that forward to the next year. And so this is the main thrust of what I want you to remember as you're thinking and looking at your projects and your learning activities and everything, is that thing on the bottom is the goal. It isn't covering material and it isn't doing activities. And let me introduce a word for you to think about against the word covering. And I'll, as an analogy, I'll use one of my favorite things to do when it comes to vacation, and that is a road trip. I love to drive. I'm from Oregon, and I'm driving from when I moved to Texas, getting my dog, putting him in the Jeep, and I was driving all the way across the country. It was awesome. There's nothing that the road can't heal when it comes to just being able to get out. And you cover miles. And you get a tank of gas, you get the right music mix going, you get on, and you go. And you go. And the miles roll behind you, and it's lovely and wonderful. But within the metaphor, ask yourself this question. When I drive many, many miles, and I've covered a lot of distance, what of those miles do I take with me? Nothing. I covered them. I went past them. There is no question that I used to be here, and now I'm here, and I covered this distance in between. Too often when we are covering material in our classes, that's what we're doing. And we get to the end, and we're figuring out how to assess and how we're going to test and hold them accountable. And what we end up doing is having to create, at least I can speak of this, that our teachers have wrestled with this, I create a review process to make sure that our students can actually produce some semblance of understanding of all that we've covered. And they have to cram a whole lot to memorize it to be able to produce it. But the understanding that they have of that is as thin as the miles are long, because all they did was cover the material. And so we see the project as, no, that's not learning. I want to do something else. Here's the word that I want you to put against covering. Discovering. Okay, so instead of covering miles, think about if I go and I'm going to find something, and let's just put it in the ground to kind of add a little bit more to the image, and I dig for it, and I dig, and I work, and I find this beautiful stone. And I take the stone out because I have discovered this stone, and I clean it off, and I polish it, and I come to know it, and then I go back. What do I have with me now? I have the discovery. I have discovered something, and I'm taking it with me. Coverage is not discovering anything. Yes, if I'm on an adventure, I'll discover certain things and I'll have that with me. But too often when we're thinking about what we're teaching, we wrestle with this tension between the amount I have to cover in my classes and the activities that I want students to do, but I don't have enough time to do them because we got places to go and we've got to cover it. And what I want us to think instead is when our projects fail, it's usually because we're trying to do a corrective to something that actually needs to be addressed. Because the coverage was where we got in trouble, because we were actually spreading our students' experiences and knowledge over too thin of a road. And what we really need to do is actually be able to say, I worked studying this material, not to cover it, but to discover it. And so how do we discover it? How are we going to do that? Chuck Evans and Robert Littlejohn wrote a book, beautiful little book, and one of the Wisdom and Eloquence, and one of the principles that they unfold in it is that classical schools are 12K, not K-12. We are not about taking kids a certain age and walking them through, and then wherever they end up at the end, that's where we are. We are backwards. We think about what we are trying to produce in our graduates, and then we work backwards from there to see how can we, over our 12 or 13 years, produce those kinds of graduates. We each have a mission statement that should actually give us very clear directions as to what that is. We have at Regents an unofficial image of that as well. We use Quintilian's definition of rhetoric, which is the good man speaking well. We like it so much, we literally carved it onto the front of our high school. So it's there. The kids walk under it every day when they come to school. Everything that we do, that doesn't happen on accident. I think we tend to think about what we're doing in our classes and say, yeah, no, we're a classical school and this is what we're producing. But it doesn't happen just accidentally. You can read Shakespeare and not come to the conclusion and move them towards the good man speaking well. You can read, you can study history and come to very different personal conclusions and visions of the world. And so for us, what we have to be, and this starts at our school level, which we all have a vision of that, but then it moves to our classes, and in our classes it moves to our units, and our units have projects. What are we trying to get them to? What is the finish line? And here's where sometimes I think we, because we are assuming that we're doing it, we miss the opportunity to actually do it well. And that is that we think of our curriculum purely in terms of academics. And so we think about the idea of understanding or knowledge as purely intellectual substance and not moral or aesthetic shaping. C.S. Lewis in Abolition of Man describes that the task of the educator is to shape the affections of the students. In our classes, we can actually be intentional about trying to do that. Do we have control of the outcome? Not at all. But we can actually say, you know what? This is geometry. Even though all I need to teach them is geometry, I have a responsibility as a geometry teacher to move our students closer to the good man speaking well. How can I, as a geometry teacher, do that through geometry? I use that as an example because we have a geometry teacher at Regents who has created a project. And me, of course, being the anti-project guy, when he proposed it the first time, I was like, no, it's horrible. And then he made the case and he explained it. And I was like, this is absolutely beautiful. And the project is simply this. Late in the year, they meet with a group from Mobile Loaves and Fishes, which is a group that works with homeless and extreme poverty in Austin. And they have created a campus, a place for people to be able to come and live. And each year, they actually have a project that they need designed and built. 2 years ago, it was a shade structure. This last year, it was a garden. And our geometry students get to design a proposal to see if it wins, to see if it's going to get built. They'll have real architects to make sure the thing doesn't fall down. But in terms of making it beautiful and accessible and human, our students get to wrestle with, okay, how will I do this? And I need to use the geometry to do that. It has clear parameters in terms of the steps and the process that they do it in. But the result is, and I've seen this now, we've done it 2 years, and it is profound for our students and as well as our larger community of their awareness of poverty in Austin and their heart response to want to do something about it. That's the geometry. That's a beautiful project. Now, if that project only has in it, in its objectives, the student's appropriate understanding of the application of the Pythagorean theorem, then they're wasting a lot of time. But what Josh Wilkerson did is embed in that project that one of the objectives is that the students would recognize the power of math to love and serve their community. They meet that, he meets that objective, and it's explicit, and it won't get lost as it gets passed down because it is tied all the way to the top of the good man speaking well. They speak well with geometry in that class through that project. But so work backwards. Building a Roman road out of cereal. What is it that I'm trying to accomplish in that? If I'm working backwards, I may find, okay, this doesn't quite fit. If I think about activity, it might be something, well, they get to see the construction of the roads because that was significant in Rome, but I think about the time and it's going to take them and they're going to have to go to Target and get 7 different kinds of cereal to layer it up appropriately. Okay, no, that's the wrong thing to do. But what do I want them to do? I want them to bring Rome and classical realities in the world to their lives. How can I do that? That also will accomplish the other things that I want. That's a different freedom. And that will be the thing that's going to guide whether my project, even as an idea, is good or not. But so we need to ask ourselves, what am I trying to get to? What are the attitudes? What are the perspectives? What are the vision and the skills that I'm actually trying to get to? There's a book title at the bottom there that I recommend. We have discovered it at Regents, and it's causing all sorts of work-life balance issues because our teachers are so excited to try and redo some of the things that they're doing that I'm needing to tell them to stop working this summer. It's an entirely secular book, and I need to say this just as a context. It's called Understanding by Designs by Grant Wiggins and Jay McKee. The secular side of it is clear because their understanding of knowledge is meaning that is created by students studying something as opposed to truly discovered and it is real and true and corresponds to objective reality. But that is irrelevant to the brilliance of helping a school say, if you have a picture of what you want to do, how do you work backwards from that to have lesson plans and activities that actually accomplish that? Not in terms of coverage, but in terms of students learning and understanding. It's a lovely book. And all sorts of extra resources that go with it. Work backwards and look at your project in that context to say, where does this fit into what it is I'm trying to do? Do I need to change it? And how do I do so? Okay. Next thing, and this goes back immediately to my hatchet job of the projects in the School of Logic at Regents 7 years ago. You need to lead the time on task to value equation. What is the ratio to the amount of time they're going to spend and the value that they are of that time that is spent? And it needs to be high. It needs to be valuable, the time that they're spending. You as a teacher can own the time that they spend on that project. More times than not, what that requires compared to where we are with a lot of our projects is we have to define the steps more clearly, and we need to give guidance on how much time to be spent on particular steps. We need to give feedback on those particular steps. And this is the most important one. We need to have a rubric that they have ahead of time of how it's going to be evaluated that only grades things that we're trying to accomplish. I'll give an example of one a number of years ago at Regents that didn't meet that. This was as my project hatchety moved into the high school, and there was a Spanish 3 project that they wrote a children's book using all of the Spanish that they knew. It was lovely and wonderful, and the teacher showed me the rubric as it was existing. She's like, I want to keep doing this. And I looked through it, and I said, as far as I can tell, I can get an 89 on this if I write my Spanish children's story in English. Because there was so much on the form and the creativity and the other elements that I could get away with not using the Spanish and actually get a high B if I got everything else right. She didn't, as soon as I pointed out, she's like, oh my gosh, you're right. And fortunately, none of our students were as deviant as I would have been at that time, which would have been to write in English to see if I could get away with it. And so she was able to revise it to actually meet it. But part of what she had to go through was, but I want them to be beautiful. I was like, okay, I know that you want it to be beautiful, but if the Spanish is excellent and it's a lovely story and they're pencil stick figures stapled together for binding, that's a beautiful book. That's what you want. So, and let Leah Watley and our art team deal with teaching art, because you actually don't even know necessarily, that's not your gifting, your skill. Your gifting skill is Spanish. And it freed her and her students to be able to do that. And it also kept kids from spending too much time on binding and coloring, which helps them take less time on that Spanish project. So leading it is, I have to help define and give them guidance on time that will be value rich. If you think about it, if anytime we are given a large project, for teachers that usually mean some sort of curriculum writing or revision, project management is hard as adults. When we do project-based learning with children, they don't have those executive skills that we draw on to figure out how to manage that project. And they are overwhelmed or completely without any guidance, and they don't even know that they're not doing it well because they don't have that context. We can train and guide them in that if we break that down. And our projects can take less time, and they can be more valuable. One word on class time. Often the response for people and the tension is, I don't have enough time in my classes to take class time on this project. And my response is, well, then I don't think the students have enough time on their schedule to do it any other time. If we have 55-minute periods at Regents, if I'm saying I can't spare 55 minutes, then I'm really assuming that it's going to take them at least 55 or more just for my class on that project. I either need to redefine it so it doesn't take them that much time, at which point, if it really is a valuable educational exercise, why not do it in class and give them class time to do that? The other thing that having some of our class time dedicated to it is that it gives us the opportunity to give them guidance, to give them feedback, to refine their energy and their work so they don't go too far down, or we'll have some that are, they're going to try and do everything perfectly, and you can actually say, I do not want you to spend any more time on this. You need to actually stop the three-dimensional color-coded contraption you have over here because it has no value to this project. Here's the rubric. Remember, please don't do that. They need that feedback, and they can't do that if they're only doing it at home. University model schools have more leeway in that, but you still have the same responsibility to define and give the students guidance on how much time they should be spending on these things. And to get, if you break it into steps and they're getting feedback on the steps, then that can help give you the input to help them through that. Last thing I want to share, and then I really want to open it up for kind of some Q&A and conversation and wrestle and see if we can do this. I teach on and off our sophomore Rhetoric 1 class, and we have a project that we've had for, I think, more than 10 years, and it is to write a Socratic dialogue. Over the course of the 8 years that I have taught the class, I think we've probably violated every single thing on your handout at some point at different times. So it definitely has been a part of our learning journey, has been making all of these mistakes as well. But I want to just kind of walk through what it looks like now, or what it looked like this last year, and kind of whatever moving forward, just to kind of have a frame of reference, and for us to have something specific to look at. So in the context of this, we spend all semester looking at Socrates. And the class is set up with this question. What's the big deal about Socrates? It's written on the whiteboard. We come back to that question. And all semester long, the students are actually contributing hypotheses to that answer that question. Well, it's because he this, or it's because that. And they're wrestling through, kind of creating, as a class, a set of answers to what's the big deal about Socrates. We have, as part of our course documents, some goals that we want our students to get to. Now, these goals aren't binary. It's not like, oh, you got them or you didn't. It's a continuum, the level of understanding they have. But these are some of the understandings that go with that. Recognizing that Socrates moved philosophy from a study of the material world to a study of man's world. that knowledge is inherently ethical and value-laden, that the understanding is a dialectical process that goes back and forth, very easily represented in literal conversations back and forth, that in any sense there is an understanding that's going through that. That often when we misunderstand things, it's because we willfully do not want to understand it. And that becomes very evident in the dialogues. And that opportunities to learn and understand things are everywhere. The dialogues happen at the most, they spring up out of the smallest of circumstances that Socrates is able to begin a conversation. So those are some of the understandings. We want them to be able to have those outside of the context of Socrates. Ideally, this class will lead to that. We hit and miss on some of those things, but what we're doing in the class is towards that. One of the ways that we evaluate at the end of the semester that, and this is where the Socratic dialogue has come to come in. It used to not function as this, but we realized it is a perfect function, is a student should be able to actually write their own Socratic dialogue. If they could write a dialogue of Socrates interacting with somebody in a way that Socrates interacted with people, they would be able to demonstrate these and other understandings of Socrates. And so it's a very real performative task, and that's the purpose of the project. So, all semester long, we read different texts about Socrates. We read 5 different short dialogues. We read Socrates Meets Jesus by Peter Kreis. We read some of Aristophanes' The Clouds to get a little different perspective on Socrates. And we engage with and wrestle with different ethical paradigms and models to see how Socrates is filtering things compared to the way that other people are filtering things. As we're doing it as a class, we're building these kind of lists of this is what we've learned about Socrates. This is who he is. We're refining it. First, we think he's a little bit of a smart aleck. Then we realize, no, he only is that with certain people and not others. And, well, it seems like it's the smart people. So they work through that and trying to figure out who he is. And then we present the final dialogue, which they've known all along they're going to have to write with some, you know, dread, as sophomores always have said about anything that's coming up. That you're going to demonstrate that you get this because you're going to write a dialogue. So even by presenting that to them before they ever get to it, it's in the back of their mind that they're going to have to do something like that. And that does shape and affect how they actually engage the material all along. We give them the criteria for evaluation. We give them, and a lot of it, they've actually produced themselves collaboratively, the identifiable traits of Socrates. Your Socrates needs to have these traits, otherwise he's in Socrates in name only. How do you demonstrate those? How do those come out? His method, his ethos, his convictions, they have to be evident. You're going to have to create some context. And sometimes they'll wrestle a little bit with, well, I want Socrates to talk to someone about why football is better than soccer. It's like, well, okay, can you do that? And that becomes the thing they have to wrestle with. Does that work or not? And they have to come to that. And then the overall structure in the form has to fit, and we narrow it so that lengthwise it matches what it should be appropriately, but it needs to follow and actually the structure and form of a dialogue. They have 2 weeks in class of working on it. There are particular checkpoints that we have within that where they have a little worksheet where they fill out different elements so that they have kind of the ingredients that they need to cook with, so to speak, and work out that so they don't get too far down with something that's actually not going to work. They have the project handout as well as the rubric that explains this is how you're going to be evaluated in this. And we workshop and do some particular things where they work on each other's and they even kind of try them out. And so that they can refine together what those look like and respond to that and be able to do that. There have been some dialogues that have come out of it, and this is where we get in trouble a little bit, I think all of us, because we start to get a little production-minded. There are some that I guarantee you I can publish. They're brilliant. There are others that are not so good. the point is not that product. The student who wrote the one that's not as good may actually understand more about Socrates than the one who stumbled upon, and there was one that wrote this brilliant one about a mother trying to protect her child from the world, and so she was looking for schools that would do that. She didn't understand what she wrote. I talked with her, and I coached her, so I knew her really well, and she had no idea what she had written. It was brilliant. I had another one that wasn't very well written, but he understood. He just wasn't able to execute a number of the things that we wanted them to learn. We have to have the ability to not get so enamored by products that we miss sight of the fact that we're doing it not for the sake of the product. We're doing it for the sake of the understanding and the learning that we're trying to foster in our students. And that, if anything, can be one of the hardest ones for us to not get sidetracked by, both in our evaluation even and in what we're working towards. Senior thesis is the ultimate project in our schools, and it's really easy to be more concerned about making sure they look good so they don't make us look bad than that they actually are achieving the objectives of understanding and character that we're actually wanting them to be able to get to, even if it looks a little messy at the end. Okay, so that is what I have to present. And now I want to have questions and ideas. Help us make this better. Yeah. It was not. That the conversations that I had with them afterwards was really, for me, it was as much, because this was the first semester class and the beginning of the semester, for me it was kind of a formative assessment of just understanding. I graded it itself on what they had completed. The one that wasn't as bad, or that wasn't necessarily as beautiful and well-written, still actually met the parameters that were needed to be met for the rubric to get a decent grade. It just didn't look as pretty as the other one.
And speaking of the rubric, I think it's right now what you were saying as far as what the rubric would have on it, it's going to be graded on.
So the traits of Socrates, the kind of method, the Socratic method that is demonstrated in that, and then we have the rubric itself actually delineates what would an A look like in each of these? What would a B look like? What would a C look like? So there's some qualitative assessments that or references that are tied to those. Other questions? Yeah. That's right. Okay, so the question, broadly speaking, is, are we just focused on the understandings? Because if part of what we're trying to accomplish is the clarity of expression, isn't that a part of it? And the answer is yes, if it's supposed to be a part of it. In a rhetoric senior thesis, clarity of expression is immediately a part of it. In the context of this project itself, sophomore level written project, what was demonstrated wasn't part of what was needed, which is why it wasn't there. But what you would want to have is a rubric that includes a facet that is going to say, there's the intellectual argument here and its order and its structure, whatever, but then there's the clarity of expression, and these are the criteria that you're trying to meet, and articulating that ahead of time so they know Okay, I may, this may be, this, I'm, it's kind of clunky, but I'm going to be able to, particularly if it's a verbal assignment, my ability to express it, that's kind of, I'm going to do better there versus on somewhere else. The question is, projects, if they're appropriate to younger grade levels, whatever would be activities that are appropriate to accomplishing what you're trying to accomplish at that grade level. So if you have a sixth grader and you are studying, you want them to understand something, what's that?
Leaves.
Classification of leaves. You would want to do a project that was appropriate for that. Don't think of, I'm trying to figure out a project to do. Figure out how do I get them to the understanding of classification of leaves appropriately. Maybe it's a project related, maybe it's not. Think towards what I'm trying to get them to be able to do and what's the genuine thing that they would do that would lead me to know I can assess how well they've done that. And I think that's where it gets tricky, is thinking through what, and that it is the hard part. How would I actually know that a student's expression of something really demonstrates understanding, as opposed to, okay, I can see what the teacher wants. I think I can do that if I do it in the next day before I forget. Yeah. My concern would be the amount of time that it probably takes them to do the Google SketchUp model on top of the research and rebuilding that would be a lot of time. The question you have to ask is what do they learn as a result of all of that time spent on that? And I think that's now, if they have a computer class and they actually have some objective of what you want them in terms of their computer skills, that's a beautiful thing. What I would say is that if you're the history teacher and you have no objectives related to computer literacy and skills, you are forcing them to learn things that are irrelevant to your course. But what you may have, and then this is where kind of our working together in terms of our disciplines, what you may have is something where your computer program has goals that it makes sense for them to do something that's related to another course, and you've got a course that actually in a subject and an activity that matches perfectly, and there you can have a doubling up. But that would be the thing, is how much time do they spend on each of these things? Where does that fit in terms of what we're trying to accomplish? And do I need to revise some of those so that that time is of high value?
Mm-hmm.
Love it. So she just, in kind of thinking through the project thing, just so for people that didn't hear, she was talking about could you do something with a leaf project where you have this open question of what's the big deal about the shape of leaves? Anything that is a question is a beautiful way to draw students towards understanding. Because if they, I mean, the initial, my initial sixth grade response would be, there is no big deal about the shape of a leaf. But as you start to learn more, you go, oh, wait, oh yeah, no, they are doing different things. And in the process of discovering that, they are actually learning about what is happening in the leaf and the tree. So that, one of the things I like about the understanding by design is that one of their elements of a curriculum is, what are the big questions that you will keep going back to if you keep studying this thing? It's not the big question that you answer once you've studied it. It's the question you keep asking as long as you're studying it, because they are these larger questions that have to do, that the discipline, they're just inherent in it. And that we all have them. Discovering those are that's the hook that pulls so many kids into learning to go, wow, okay, I can't get a satisfying answer, and yet that pulls me further in, or gives me appreciation for how complex and beautiful it is. I think you'd have to ask, to know the answer to it, I think you'd have to ask what skills am I going to require of them? How am I going to structure it so I can give them feedback? And for the really, really eager girls, they're going to go way overboard. How do I put fences around it so she doesn't spend too much time on it? And then create it in such a way that I meet those parameters. And I love it. Dr. Seuss leaves are very important. In the back. No. Right. Yeah, good. So the question is, how do you balance as part of the objective that we want successful communicators? We want people that we're actually presenting our knowledge and understanding as part of learning. Structure it in such a way that you can give feedback on that, that you let them know that you are going to give feedback on that, and make sure that the nature of the presentation is developing the skills that you want. And there's nothing wrong with the skills to put together a PowerPoint. You have to decide as a school, where do we want to have our focus on what skills? We at Regents, we actually allow students to use visual aids for their senior thesis, and we've had one student do it in the history of our school, and it was really, every time kids have tried to do it, because they know what they're being evaluated on when it comes to communication, they're too worried about it not working, and they know how detrimental that would be to the persuasiveness of their case, and so they choose not to. So it's fine to have, as part of your goal, I want them to be able to present their ideas and their discoveries and their learnings and understandings in different ways. But order it in such a way that that's intentional, not just say, well, yeah, we want that to happen as well, so that's going to be my justification for it. Build it into the nature of the assignment itself so that they know how to do that well. And then one more question, I think, and then we're going to be done. Yeah, the question is about kind of slow workers, slow processors, and using class in time. How do you balance that? I would allow them to use more time after that. It's not like the skill that we're working towards isn't to do certain amounts of work in certain amounts of time. It's we want to give them the time to do that. We've got a wide range of kids, and so if someone, and maybe they're a slow processor, and that's why it takes them more time, or they may have gone way down a path that they thought was excellent, and then at the end of class they realize, nope, I need to actually go and do this. That's the fun of the learning process, to say, of course, don't worry about it. Let's find some time once you come after school, or take it home and once you show me tomorrow. I mean, that's where the natural, let's figure out how to do this in a way that taps into what your own desires to actually do it well, but make sure that you're giving them time and opportunities to do that at home as well as going away. I don't have a question. Was if we have a resource for age-appropriate skills that would be appropriate for each project. We don't necessarily have one that like kind of a master list. Our school has a kind of our ongoing process of what we think the answers to those questions are, and at any particular grade level, those grade teams are, we work to be in sync with what we're expecting so that it's all at the same level. Places where that's really appropriate is if you have math and science students doing writing or presenting or discussing, which they're not spending as much time in the training of that as they are in the math and science compared to the humanities, making sure that they have the same level of expectations as the humanities and not higher or lower just out of naivete means we need to talk together. No sense. Okay, I'm going to let y'all go, but if anyone wants to ask questions or come chat, please come on up. Thanks, y'all. Hi, I saw your hands go up right there, too.